"As to what he has been doing, madame," said D'Artagnan, "I believe that his only crime consists in having at the same time the good fortune and the misfortune of being your husband."
"Then, sir, you know?"
"I know that you were carried off, madame."
"But by whom? Do you know that? Oh, if you know, pray tell me."
"By a man about 40 or 45 years of age, with dark hair, a brown complexion, and a scar on the left temple."
"Just so, just so. But his name?"
"Ah, his name. I don't know it myself."
"And did my husband know that I had been carried off?"
"He had been informed of it by a letter sent him by the ravisher himself."
"And does he suspect," demanded Madame Bonacieux, with some confusion, "the cause of this abduction?"
"He attributes it, I believe, to some political cause."
"At first I doubted whether it was so, but now, as I think, he does. And so, my dear Monsieur Bonacieux did not mistrust me for a single instant?"
"Ah, so far from that, madame, he was too proud of your prudence and your love." A second smile, almost imperceptible, glided over the rosy lips of the beautiful young woman. "But," continued D'Artagnan, "how did you make your escape?"
"I profited by a moment in which I was left alone, and as I learned this morning the cause of my abduction, by the help of my sheets I got out of the window and hurried here, where I expected to find my husband."
"To place yourself under his protection?"
"Oh, no, poor dear man. I knew that he was incapable of protecting me. But as he might be of some service to us, I wished to put him on his guard."
"Against what?"
"Alas, that is not my secret, and I dare not tell it to you."
"Besides," said D'Artagnan, "pardon me, madame, if protector as I am, I remind you of prudence. Besides, I think that we are scarcely in a situation suitable for confidences. The men whom I have put to flight will return reinforced, and if they find us here, we shall be lost. I have sent to summon 3 of my friends, but it is uncertain whether they may be at home."
"Yes, yes, you are right," said Madame Bonacieux in alarm. "Let us fly, let us escape."
And seizing D'Artagnan by his arm, she eagerly drew him along. "But whither shall we fly? Where shall we escape to?" said D'Artagnan.
"Let us get away from this place first, and then, having got clear of it, we shall see."
Without taking the trouble to shut the door, the 2 young people hastily passed down the Rue des Fossoyeurs, crossed the Rue des Fosses Monsieur le Prince, and did not stop until they reached the Place de Saint-Sulpice. "And now what next?" inquired D'Artagnan. "And whither would you like me to conduct you?"
"I confess that I scarcely know whither," said Madame Bonacieux. "I had intended, through my husband, to intimate my escape to Monsieur de la Porte, so that the latter might tell us exactly what has happened at the Louvre within the last 3 days, and whether there would be any danger in my presenting myself there."
"But I," said D'Artagnan, "can go and inform Monsieur de la Porte."
"Undoubtedly. Yet there is one difficulty. Monsieur Bonacieux is known at the Louvre, and would be allowed to enter, whilst you, not being known, would not be admitted."
"Nonsense," said D'Artagnan. "There is doubtless a porter at some wicket of the Louvre who is devoted to you, and who, thanks to some countersign—"
Madame Bonacieux looked earnestly at the young man.
"And if I trusted you with this countersign," said she, "would you undertake to forget it as soon as you had made use of it?"
"On my word of honour, on the faith of a gentleman," said D'Artagnan, with that accent of truth which never can mislead.
"Well, I believe you. You look like a man of honour, and your fortune perhaps may depend on your devotion."
"I will perform, without any promises, and conscientiously, whatever I can to serve the king, and to be acceptable to the queen," said D'Artagnan. "Use me, therefore, as a friend."
"But what is to become of me in the meantime?"
"Have you no acquaintance to whose house Monsieur de la Porte can come for you?"
"No, I would rather not trust to anyone."
"Wait," said D'Artagnan. "We are just now by Athos's door. Yes, this is the best way."
"And who is Athos?"
"A friend of mine."
"But if he is at home and sees me—"
"But he is not there, and I will take away the key when I have placed you in his apartment."
"Suppose he should return?"
"He will not return. Besides, if he should, he will be told that I have brought a woman here, and that she is now in his apartment."
"But don't you see this will compromise me very much?"
"What need you care? No one knows you. Besides, we are not in a position to be particular."
"Well, let us go to your friend's house, then. Where does he live?"
in the Rue Ferou, 2 steps from here.
Come, then.
And the two proceeded on their way. As D'Artagnan had foreseen, Athos was not at home. So, taking the key, which they were in the habit of giving to him as a friend of the musketeer, he ascended the stairs and introduced Madame Bonancieux into the little apartment which we have already described.
"You are now at home," said he. "Lock the door inside, and do not open it to anyone, unless you hear 3 knocks, thus." And he tapped 3 times. 2 taps together, pretty hard, and after a short interval, a gentler tap.
"That will do," said Madame Bonancieux. "And now let me give you my instructions."
"I am all attention."
"Present yourself at the postern of the Louvre, on the side of the Rue de la Chelle, and ask for Germain."
"Very well. And what next?"
"He will ask you what you want. You must answer by these words, Tours and Brussels, and he will immediately listen to your commands."
"And what shall I tell him to do?"
"To go and find Monsieur de Laporte, the Queen's valet de chambre."
"And when Monsieur de Laporte has come?"
"You will send him to me."
"Very well. But where and how shall I see you again?"
"Do you feel particularly anxious to see me again?"
"Particularly."
"Well, then, leave that to my care. And be at ease."
"I rely upon your word."
"And quite right."
D'Artagnan took leave of Madame Bonancieux with the most amorous glance that he could possibly concentrate upon her charming little person. And whilst he was descending the stairs, he heard the door behind him double locked. In 2 bounds he was at the Louvre, and as he entered the small door in the Rue de la Chelle, it struck 10, so that all the events we have just related had transpired within 30 minutes. Everything happened just as Madame Bonancieux had predicted. Germain heard the watchword with a bow, and in 10 minutes de la Porte was in the porter's lodge, and in 2 words D'Artagnan told him what had occurred, and where Madame Bonancieux was to be found. Laporte made himself certain of the address by having it twice repeated, and then hurried away. But he had scarcely taken 10 steps before he returned.
"Young man," said he, "let me give you some good counsel."
"What is it?"
"You may possibly get into some trouble on account of this affair."
"Do you think so?"
"I do. Have you any friend whose clock is slow?"
"Suppose I have."
"Go and pay him a visit, that he may be able to bear witness that you were in his company at 9:30. In law, that is what is called an alibi."
D'Artagnan thought the advice prudent. He therefore took to his heels and reached Monsieur de Tréville's. But instead of entering the drawing-room with the rest of the company, he asked to be admitted into the cabinet, and as he was one of the habitual frequenters of the hotel, no objection was made to this. And Monsieur de Tréville was soon informed that his young compatriot, having something of importance to communicate, solicited a private interview. In 5 minutes Monsieur de Tréville was there, and asked D'Artagnan what he could do for him, and to what he was indebted for a visit at such a late hour.
"Forgive me, sir," said D'Artagnan, who had taken advantage of the moment he was left alone to put the clock back 3/4 hour. "But I thought, as it was only 9:25, it was not yet too late to wait upon you."
9:25? Exclaimed Monsieur de Tréville, looking at the clock. "It is impossible."
"Look for yourself, sir," said D'Artagnan. "The clock shows it."
"You're right," replied Monsieur de Tréville. "I should have thought it was later. But what can I do for you?"
Then D'Artagnan entered into a long story about the Queen, expressing all the fears that he had entertained upon Her Majesty's account, and recounting all that he had heard about the Cardinal's designs against Buckingham, and this with a degree of tranquillity and consistency by which Monsieur de Tréville was the more readily duped, inasmuch as he had himself, as we have already said, remarked that something fresh was stirring between the Cardinal, the King, and the Queen. Just as the clock was striking 10, D'Artagnan arose and took his leave of Monsieur de Tréville, who thanked him for his information, expressed on him an incessant earnestness in the service of the King and Queen, and returned to his saloon. But D'Artagnan remembered, at the bottom of the stairs, that he had forgotten his cane. He therefore hastened up again, re-entered the cabinet, and with 1 touch of his finger put the clock to its right time, so that it might not be seen the next day to have been wrong. Then, satisfied that he had a witness there to prove his alibi, he again descended the stairs, and soon found himself in the street. 11. The intrigue becomes confused. When his visit to Monsieur de Treville was ended, D'Artagnan took, in pensive mood, the longest road to return to his own home. But what were the meditations which thus led him from his way, contemplating with successive sighs and smiles the stars that glittered in the sky? Alas, he was intent on Madame Bonacieux. To an apprentice musketeer, the charms of that young person raised her almost into an ideal of love. Pretty, mysterious, and initiated into all the court secrets, which reflected so much charming seriousness over her seductive features, he supposed her also to be not wholly unimpassioned, which is an irresistible attraction to novices in these engagements of the heart. He felt, moreover, that he had delivered her from the hands of miscreants who wished to search and maltreat her, and this important service had prepossessed her with a sentiment of gratitude towards him which might easily be made to take a character of greater tenderness. So rapidly do our dreams travel on imagination's wings that D'Artagnan already fancied himself accosted by some messenger from Madame Bonacieux, handing to him an appointment for an interview, or a diamond, or a chain of gold. We have already intimated that the young cavaliers were not then ashamed of accepting presents from their king, and we may add that in those times of easy morality they were not more scrupulous in respect of their mistresses, and that these latter almost always conferred upon them some precious and durable memorials, as though they were endeavouring to overcome the instability of their sentiments by the solidity of gifts. Men did not then blush at owing their advancement to women, and we might refer to many amongst the heroes of that age of gallantry who would neither have won their spurs at first nor their battles afterwards, but for the better or worse furnished purse which some mistress had suspended at their saddle-bow. Now D'Artagnan possessed nothing. His provincial hesitation, that superficial varnish and ephemeral bloom, that down on the peach, had evaporated in the storm of somewhat unorthodox advice which the three musketeers had given to their friend. According to the curious customs of the time, he had come to look upon himself as being just as much engaged in a campaign whilst he was at Paris as though he had been in Flanders. Spaniard there, woman here. Yet, in either case, there was an enemy to overcome, and contributions to raise. But let us not disguise that the young Gascon was, at present, influenced by a nobler and more disinterested feeling. The mercer had confessed to him that he was rich, and it was easy to infer that, with a simpleton like Bonacieux, the wife would be the keeper of the purse. But nothing of this kind had contributed to that sentiment which the sight of Madame Bonacieux had inspired, and selfishness had been almost disregarded in the dawning love which had arisen from his interview. We say almost, for the assurance that a young, lovely, charming, and witty woman is rich also has a tendency not to diminish, but rather to corroborate, this growth of sentiment. In easy circumstances, there are a crowd of aristocratic cares and caprices which accord well with beauty. A white and fine stocking, a silken dress, a lace kerchief, a pretty little shoe, a becoming riband, do not make an ugly woman pretty, but they make a pretty woman irresistible. Whilst her hands, moreover, are sure to be the gainers by her wealth, for the hands, in women especially, must remain idle to be beautiful. Now, as the reader very well knows, for we have made no secret of the state of his finances, D'Artagnan was not a man of large fortune. It is true that he quite expected to become so at some future time, but the date which he had himself fixed on for that happy transformation was as yet far distant. In the meantime, what sorrow would it be to see the woman whom one idolizes sighing for the thousand trifles in which so much of the happiness of womankind consists, and to be unable to procure them for her? But when the woman is rich, although the lover is poor, the gifts which he cannot present she can provide for herself. And then, although it may most frequently be with the husband's money that these enjoyments are obtained, it is not commonly to this husband that the gratitude is shown. Thus disposed to become the most passionate of admirers, D'Artagnan had not ceased to be a devoted friend. In the midst of his more tender feelings towards the mercer's wife, he was not forgetful of his companions. The pretty Madame Bonacieux was the very woman to take on an excursion to the plain of Saint-Denis, or the fair at Saint-Germain, in company with Athos, Porthos, and Aramis, to whom he should be so proud to show his charming conquest. And then, as D'Artagnan had happened to remark of late, after a long walk one gets hungry, and they would have some of those pleasant little dinners, during which one touches on this side the hand of a friend, on that the foot of a mistress. Finally, in moments of emergency, in great extremities, might it not be his happiness to be the saviour of his friends? But what of Monsieur Bonancieux, whom D'Artagnan had given over to the keeping of the officers, disowning him aloud, whilst, in a whisper, he assured him of his care? We must confess to our readers that D'Artagnan had never thought of him at all. Or, if he did think of him, it was merely to congratulate himself that he was very well where he was, wherever that might be. Love is the most selfish of all our passions. Nevertheless, let our readers take comfort. Though D'Artagnan forgets his landlord, or pretends to forget him, under the excuse of not knowing where he has been taken, we have not forgotten him, and do know where he is. But for the present, let us act like the amorous Gascon. As for the worthy mercer, we will return to him by and by. D'Artagnan, whilst meditating on his future love, and conversing with the night, and smiling on the stars, proceeded along the Rue de Cherche Midi, or Chasse Midi, as it was then called. Being in Aramis's neighbourhood, he thought he might as well pay him a visit, to explain why he had sent Planchet with the invitation to come immediately to the mousetrap. If Planchet had found Aramis at home, the latter had probably hastened to the Rue des Fossoyeurs, and finding nobody there but his other two friends, perhaps they would all have been in ignorance of what the summons meant. This dilemma needed some explanation, or at least so said D'Artagnan aloud. But in his inner soul he thought that this call would give him an opportunity of talking of the pretty Madame Bonancieux, with whom his mind, if not his heart, was already quite occupied. It is not in regard to a first love that we must look for discretion. The joy with which such a love is attended is so exuberant that it must overflow, or it would suffocate us. For the last 2 hours Paris had been dark and nearly deserted. 11 o'clock was striking from all the clocks of the Faubourg Saint-Germain. The time was mild, and D'Artagnan was passing down a small street situated on the ground where the Rue d'Assas now stands, where the air was redolent of odours which were borne on the wind along the Rue de Vaugirard, from gardens that the evening dews and the gentle gales refreshed. Afar off, though deadened by substantial shutters, was heard the revelry of the wine shops which were scattered over the flat quarters. Having reached the end of this street, D'Artagnan turned to the left. The house where Aramis lived was situated between the Rue Cassette and the Rue Servandoni. D'Artagnan had already passed by the Rue Cassette, and could just perceive the door of his friend's house, embosomed amidst sycamores and clematis, when he saw something like a shadow which came out of the Rue Servandoni. This something was enveloped in a cloak, and D'Artagnan at first thought it was a man, but from the smallness of its size, the irresolution of its manner, and its impeded step, he soon became convinced that it must be a woman. And, moreover, this woman, as though she was uncertain of the house she sought for, lifted up her eyes to examine, stopped, turned back, and then retraced her steps. D'Artagnan was at a loss. "Suppose I should go and proffer my services," thought he. "By her manner it is evident that she is young, and perhaps she is pretty. Oh, yes, but then a woman who runs about the streets at this hour seldom goes out except to meet a lover. Plague! If I should interrupt an appointment, it would be but a bad kind of introduction." The young woman, however, still came forward, counting the windows and the houses. This was not indeed a long or difficult operation. There were but 3 hotels in that part of the street, and but 2 windows looking upon the thoroughfare, of which one was that of a pavilion, parallel to the pavilion of Aramis, and the other that of Aramis himself. "By Jove!" said D'Artagnan to himself, as he suddenly remembered the theologian's niece. "By Jove! It would be droll if this wandering dove is looking for my friend's house. But upon my soul, it seems very like it. Ah, my dear Aramis, I will be satisfied about it once and for all." Making himself as small as possible, D'Artagnan concealed himself in the most obscure part of the street, near a stone bench placed at the back of a niche. The young woman continued to advance, for besides the lightness of her step which had betrayed her, a slight, small cough had also denoted a gentle voice. D'Artagnan concluded that this cough was a signal. Nevertheless, whether this cough had been answered by some corresponding signal which had ended the uncertainties of her nocturnal search, or whether, without any such external aid, she perceived herself to have found her journey's end, the lady advanced resolutely, and knocked three times at equal intervals, and with a bent finger, on the shutter of Aramis's window.
"It is really at Aramis's house," muttered D'Artagnan. "Ah, Mr. Hypocrite, I catch you studying theology."
Scarcely had the three taps been given before the inner casement opened and a light appeared.
"Ah," said the listener, "not at the door, but the window. Ah, the visit was expected. Come, the shutter will be opened presently, and the lady will get in by escalade." "Good."
But, to his great astonishment, the shutter continued closed, and, what was more, the light which had flashed for an instant disappeared, and all became dark again. D'Artagnan thought that this could not last, and continued to watch with all his eyes and ears. He was right. In a few seconds two knocks were heard from the inside, and when the young woman of the street answered by one knock, the shutter opened. It may be judged if D'Artagnan did not look and listen eagerly. Unfortunately, the light had been removed into some other room, but the eyes of the young man were accustomed to the darkness. Besides, it is said that the eyes of Gascons, like those of cats, have the faculty of seeing in the night. D'Artagnan was able, therefore, to see the young woman take from her pocket something white, which she unfolded quickly, and which took the form of a pocket handkerchief, and she then drew the attention of the person she addressed to the corner of the object she unfolded. This reminded D'Artagnan of the handkerchief he had found at the feet of Madame Bonancieux, which also had recalled to his recollection the one that he had drawn from under the foot of Aramis. What the deuce, then, could this handkerchief mean? Situated as he was, D'Artagnan could not see the countenance of Aramis. We say Aramis because the young man had no doubt that it was his friend who was conversing from the inside with the lady on the outside. His curiosity, therefore, overcame his prudence, and, profiting by the earnest attention which the sight of the handkerchief excited in the two persons whom we have described, he left his place of concealment, and, quickly as lightning, yet with cautious step, he placed himself near a corner of the wall, from which his eye could completely overlook the inside of Aramis's apartment. On reaching this spot, he was scarcely able to restrain an exclamation of surprise. It was not Aramis who was conferring with the midnight visitor, but a woman. D'Artagnan could just discern enough to recognize the general aspect of her vesture, but not to distinguish her features. At that moment, the woman in the room drew a handkerchief from her own pocket and exchanged it for the one which had been shown to her. A few words were then pronounced by the two women, the shutter was closed, and the woman in the street returned and, lowering the hood of her cloak, passed within 4 paces of D'Artagnan. But her precaution had been taken too late. He had already recognized Madame Bonancieux. Madame Bonancieux! The suspicion had already crossed his mind when he saw her take the handkerchief from her pocket. But what probability was there that Madame Bonancieux, who had sent for Monsieur de la Porte in order that he might conduct her to the Louvre, should be coursing through the streets of Paris at 11:30 at night, at the hazard of being carried off a second time? It must unquestionably be on some important affair. And what affair is of importance to a woman of 25 but love? But was it on her own account, or that of some other person, that she exposed herself to this risk? This was the inward doubt of the young man, whom the demon of jealousy was now tormenting, as though he had been an acknowledged lover. To satisfy himself as to where Madame Bonancieux was going, there was, in fact, one very simple way, which was to follow her. So simple, indeed, did this course appear, that D'Artagnan adopted it naturally, and as it were by instinct. But at the sight of the young man who moved from the wall, like a statue escaping from its alcove, and at the sound of his steps behind her, Madame Bonancieux uttered a faint scream and fled. D'Artagnan ran after her, It was no great difficulty for him to catch a woman encumbered by a large cloak. He overtook her, in fact, before she had gone a third of the length of the street. The poor woman was exhausted, not by fatigue, but terror, and when D'Artagnan put his hand upon her shoulder, she sunk upon one knee, exclaiming in a suffocated voice, "I will die before you learn anything." D'Artagnan raised her up by placing his arm round her waist, but perceiving by her weight that she was upon the point of fainting, he hastened to encourage her by protestations of devotion. These protestations were of no avail against Madame Bonacieux, for they may easily be made with the most mischievous intentions in the world. But the voice was everything. The young woman thought that she recognized that voice. She opened her eyes, threw one glance upon the man who had so frightened her, and seeing that it was D'Artagnan, gave utterance to a cry of joy.
"Oh, it is you! It is you!"
she said.
"God be thanked!"
"Yes, it is I," said D'Artagnan, "whom God has sent to guard you."
"And was it with this intent that you followed me?"
asked the young woman, with a smile full of coquetry. For all her fears had vanished, and her love of badinage had resumed its ascendancy, on the instant that she recognized a friend in him whom she had dreaded as a foe. "No," replied D'Artagnan. "No, I confess that it is chance which put me on your track. I saw a woman knocking at the window of one of my friends."
"One of your friends?"
interrupted Madame Bonacieux. "Yes, certainly. Aramis is one of my intimates."
"Aramis? Who is he?"
"Come now, do you pretend to tell me that you do not know Aramis?"
"It is the first time that I ever heard his name."
"Then it is the first time that you have visited this house?"
"Yes, indeed."
"And you did not know that a young man occupied it?"
"No."
"A musketeer?"
"By no means."
"Then it was not him that you came to look for?"
"Most assuredly not. Besides, you must have plainly seen that the person whom I talked to was a woman."
"That is true. But then this woman is one of Aramis's friends."
"I know nothing about that."
"Why, she lodges at his house."
"That is not my affair."
"But who is she?"
"Oh, that is not my secret."
"My dear Madame Bonacieux, you are very charming, but you are at the same time the most mysterious creature."
"Is that to my loss?"
"No, on the contrary, it lends you enchantment."
"As that is the case, give me your arm."
"With great pleasure. What now?"
"Now, take care of me."
"Where to?"
"Where I am going."
"But where may that be?"
"You will see, since you will leave me at the door."
"May I wait for you there?"
"That would be useless."
"Then you will return alone?"
"Possibly."
"But the person who will accompany you afterwards, will it be a man or a woman?"
"I do not know yet."
"But I will find out."
"And how so?"
"I will wait to see you come out."
"In that case, adieu."
"But why?"
"I do not want you."
"But you claimed my protection."
"I claimed the assistance of a gentleman, and not the vigilance of a spy."
"You are severe."
"How would you call those who follow people who don't want them?"
"Indiscreet."
"The term is too mild."
"Come, madame, I see that one must obey you."
"Why deprive yourself of the merit of doing so at once?"
"Is there none in my repentance?"
"But do you sincerely repent?"
"I don't know that myself. But I do know that I promise to do just what you wish, if you will let me accompany you where you are going."
"And you will leave me afterwards?"
"Yes."
"Without awaiting my exit?"
"Certainly."
"On your word of honor?"
"On the word of a gentleman."
"Then take my arm, and let us get on."
D'Artagnan offered his arm, which Madame Bonacieux, half laughing and half trembling, accepted, and they reached the top of the Rue de la Harpe. But the young woman appeared to hesitate there, as she had hesitated before at the Rue Vaugirard. Nevertheless, by certain marks, she appeared to recognize a door, which she approached.
"Now, sir," said she, "it is here that my business calls me. I return you 1,000 thanks for your good company, which has saved me from all the dangers to which I should have been exposed alone. But the time is now come for you to keep your word. You must leave me here."
"And will you be exposed to no danger in returning?"
"I shall only have to fear robbers."
"Is that nothing?"
"What could they take from me? I have not a farthing in my possession.
You forget that beautiful embroidered handkerchief with the arms on it.
Which?
That which I found at your feet and replaced in your pocket.
Silence! Silence, you impudent man! Would you ruin me?
You see now that there is still some danger, since one word makes you tremble, and you confess that if this word was heard you would be ruined. Come now, madame, continued D'Artagnan, seizing her hand. Be more generous. Put some confidence in me. Have you not read in my eyes that my heart is full of sympathy and devotion?
Yes, said Madame Bonacieux, and do but ask me for my own secrets, and I will trust you with them all, but those of others are a different matter.
Very well, replied D'Artagnan. Then I will find them out. Since these secrets have an influence on your life, it is necessary that they should become mine also.
Have a care,
exclaimed the young woman, in a tone of seriousness which made D'Artagnan shudder involuntarily.
Oh, do not interfere in anything that concerns me. Do not seek to aid me in any of my undertakings. Avoid them, I beseech you, in the name of the interest that you feel for me, and in the name of that service which you rendered to me, and which I never shall forget whilst my life lasts.
Let me advise you rather to think of me no more. Let my existence be obliterated from your mind. Let me be to you as though you had never chanced to see me.
Would you like Aramis to do the same, madame? Asked D'Artagnan, full of jealousy.
This makes the second or third time that you have mentioned that name, sir, although I have already told you that I do not know the owner of it.
You do not know the man at whose window shutters you went to knock? Come, madame, you must think me credulous indeed.
Confess that it is to keep me talking here that you have invented this tale and this person.
I invent nothing, madame, nothing. I am telling the exact truth.
And you say that one of your friends lives in that house?
I say it, and I repeat it for the third time. That house is inhabited by a friend of mine, and that friend is Aramis.
All this will be explained by and by, murmured the young woman. And now, sir, be silent.
If you could see into my heart, said D'Artagnan, you would discover so much curiosity that you would have pity on me, and so much love that you would directly satisfy my curiosity. You ought not to distrust those who love you.
You come quickly to love, sir, said the young woman, shaking her head.
It is because love has come quickly on me, and for the first time, and I am not yet 20 years of age.
The young woman stole a glance at him.
Listen, continued D'Artagnan, I am already on the track. 3 months ago I was near fighting a duel with Aramis on account of a handkerchief like that which you showed the lady who was at his house. It was on account of a handkerchief marked in the same manner, I am positive.
Sir, said the young woman, you really bore me, I declare, with these questions.
But you, madame, prudent as you are, suppose you were arrested with this handkerchief upon you, and the handkerchief was seized, would you not be compromised?
How so? Are not the initials my own? C.B. Constance Bonacieux.
Or Camille de Bois-Tracy.
Silence, sir! Again, I say silence! Oh, since the dangers which I run do not deter you, think of those you may run yourself.
I?
Yes, you! There is the danger of imprisonment and death in knowing me.
Then I will never leave you.
Sir,
said the young woman, in a tone of supplication, clasping her hands as she spoke.
In the name of heaven, by the honor of a soldier, by the courtesy of a gentleman, I implore you to leave me. See, it is now striking 12, the very hour at which I am expected.
Madame, said the young man, bowing, I can refuse nothing solicited in those terms. Be reassured, I leave you.
But you will not follow, will not watch me?
No. I shall return home immediately.
Ah, I was convinced that you were an honorable man,
exclaimed Madame Bonacieux, offering one of her hands to him, as she placed the other on the knocker of a small door, which was well nigh concealed in a recess. D'Artagnan seized the hand which was offered to him, and kissed it eagerly.
Alas, exclaimed D'Artagnan, with that unpolished simplicity which women sometimes prefer to the delicacies of politeness, because it illuminates the depths of thought and proves that feeling is more powerful than reason. I wish I had never seen you.
"Well," said Madame Bonacieux, in a tone almost affectionate, and pressing the hand which held hers, "well, I will not say the same as you do. That which is lost today may not be lost forever. Who knows whether, when I am freed from my present embarrassments, I may not satisfy your curiosity?"
"And do you make the same promise regarding my love?" asked the overjoyed D'Artagnan.
"Oh, I dare give no promises in that respect. It must depend upon the sentiments with which you may inspire me."
"But at present, madame?"
"At present, sir, I have not got beyond gratitude."
"Alas, you are too charming, and only take advantage of my love."
"No, I take advantage of your generosity, that's all. But believe me, with some people, nothing can be wholly lost."
"You make me the happiest of men. Oh, do not forget this evening and this promise."
"Be assured, I will remember everything at the right time and place. But now go, go, in heaven's name. I was expected at midnight, and am behind my time."
"By 5 minutes."
"But under certain circumstances, 5 minutes are 5 ages.
"Yes, when one loves."
"Well, who has told you that this is not a love affair?"
"It is a man who expects you," cried D'Artagnan. "A man!"
"There now, the discussion is about to be renewed," cried Madame Bonacieux, with a half-smile, which was not altogether exempt from impatience.
"No, I am going. I trust you. I wish to have all the merit of my devotion, even if I am a fool for it. Adieu, madame, adieu."
Then, as though he felt himself too weak to relinquish the fair hand he held but by a shock, he hastily ran off, whilst Madame Bonancieux rapped 3 times at the door, slowly and regularly, as she had before done at the window shutter. At the corner of the street he turned, but the door had been opened and closed again, and the mercer's pretty wife had disappeared. D'Artagnan proceeded on his way. He had promised Madame Bonancieux not to watch her, and, had his life depended on a knowledge of the place that she was going to, or the person who went with her, he would still have gone home, as he had promised to do. In 5 minutes he was in the Rue de Fossoyeur.
"Poor Athos," said he, "he will not understand this. He will have fallen asleep waiting for me, or he will have returned home and will have learned that there has been a woman there, a woman at his house." "After all," continued D'Artagnan, "there certainly was one at Aramis's. All this is very strange, and I shall be extremely curious to know how it will end."
"Badly, sir, badly," replied a voice,
which the young man recognized as that of Planchet, for in soliloquizing aloud, in the manner of persons who are deeply occupied, he had entered the passage at the bottom of which was his own staircase.
"How badly? What are you saying, you fool?" said D'Artagnan. "And what has happened?"
"All sorts of misfortunes."
"What misfortunes?"
"In the first place, Monsieur Athos is arrested."
"Arrested? Athos arrested? And what for?"
"He was found in your lodgings, and they mistook him for you."
"And by whom has he been arrested?"
"By the guard, which was brought by the men in black, whom you put to flight."
"Why did he not give his name? Why not say that he was not concerned in this affair?"
"He was very careful not to do that, sir. On the contrary, he came near me and said, 'Thy master wants his liberty just now, and I do not need mine, since he knows all, and I know nothing. They will believe him to be in custody, and that will give him time. In 3 days I will declare who I am, and they will be obliged to let me go.'"
"Brave Athos, noble heart," muttered D'Artagnan. "I recognize him well in that. And what did the officers do?"
4 of them took him either to the Bastille or to Fort L'Evêque, and the 2 remained with the men in black, rummaging everywhere and carrying away all your papers. The other 2 mounted guard at the door whilst all this was doing, and at last they went away, leaving the house empty and the door open."
"And Porthos and Aramis?"
"I could not find them. They have not been."
"But they may come at any moment, for you left word that I was waiting for them."
"Yes, sir."
"Well, then, do not stir from here. If they should come, tell them what has happened, and that they must wait for me at the Pineapple Tavern. There might be some danger here. The house may be watched. I will run to Monsieur de Treville's to tell him all this, and then will rejoin them there."
"Very well, sir," said Planchet.
"But you will remain? You will not be afraid?" said D'Artagnan, turning back a step to encourage his lackey.
"Be easy, sir," said Planchet. "You do not know me yet. I am brave when I please to set about it. The great thing is to get me in the right mind. Besides, I come from Picardy."
"Then it is all settled," said D'Artagnan. "You will rather die than desert your post."
"Yes, sir, and I will stick at nothing to prove my attachment to you."
"Good," said D'Artagnan to himself. "It is plain that the method I have followed with this lad is decidedly a proper one. I will adopt it henceforth on every occasion." And as fast as his legs, which were already somewhat fatigued, could carry him, he ran towards the Rue de Colombier. Monsieur de Treville was not at home. His company was on guard at the Louvre, and he was at the Louvre with it. It was necessary, however, to see Monsieur de Treville. It was important that he should be informed of these events. D'Artagnan determined, therefore, to obtain an entrance at the Louvre. His uniform, as one of Monsieur des Essarts' guards, ought to be a passport for admission. He therefore went down to the Rue des Petits Augustins, and along the quay to reach the Pont Neuf. He had half a mind to cross the ferry, but on reaching the side of the river he mechanically put his hand into his pocket, and found that he had not enough to pay the ferryman. When he reached the top of the Rue Guénégaud, he saw two persons whose appearance struck him, coming out of the Rue Dauphine. They were a man and a woman. The woman resembled in figure Madame Bonancieux, and the man had such a look of Aramis that he might be mistaken for him. Besides, the woman had on the black mantle which D'Artagnan still seemed to see delineated on the shutter in the Rue Vaugirard, and on the door in the Rue de la Harpe. Moreover, the man wore the uniform of the musketeers. The hood of the woman was lowered, and the man held his handkerchief before his face. This double precaution showed that they were both anxious to escape recognition. They went over the bridge, and this was also D'Artagnan's road, as he was going to the Louvre. He therefore followed them. Scarcely, however, had he taken 20 steps before he was convinced that the woman was Madame Bonancieux and the man Aramis. At the very instant he felt fermenting in his heart all the suspicious torments of jealousy. He was doubly betrayed, betrayed both by his friend and by her whom he had already loved as a mistress. Madame Bonancieux had sworn to him that she did not know Aramis, and a quarter of an hour after she had made this oath he found her hanging on his arm. D'Artagnan did not reflect that he had only known the mercer's pretty wife during the last 3 hours, that she only owed him a little gratitude for having delivered her from the men in black, who wished to carry her away, and that she had made him no promise. He looked upon himself as an outraged lover, as deceived and laughed at, and the flush of anger passed over his face as he resolved to ascertain the truth. The young couple perceived that they were followed, and they increased their haste. D'Artagnan, however, had made his determination. He passed by them, and then returned towards them just as they were opposite the Samaritan, which was lighted by a lamp that threw its radiance over all that part of the bridge. D'Artagnan stopped in front of them, and they stopped also.
"What do you want, sir?"
asked the musketeer, recoiling a step, and in a foreign accent, which proved to D'Artagnan that he had at least deceived himself in one of his conjectures.
"It is not Aramis!" exclaimed D'Artagnan.
"No, sir, it is not Aramis, and as I find by your exclamation that you mistook me for another, I excuse you."
"Excuse me, indeed!" said D'Artagnan.
"Yes," replied the unknown. "Now let me pass on, since it is not with me that you have anything to do."
"You are right, sir," said D'Artagnan. "It is not with you that I have anything to settle. It is with the lady."
"With the lady? You do not even know her," exclaimed the stranger.
"You are mistaken, sir. I do know her."
"Ah," said Madame Bonancieux in a reproachful tone, "I had your word of honour as a soldier, your promise as a gentleman, and I hoped I might have trusted to them."
"And I," said D'Artagnan in confusion, "I had your promise."
"Take my arm, madame," said the stranger, "and let us proceed."
But D'Artagnan, stunned, overwhelmed, annihilated by all that had happened, remained standing, with his arms crossed, before the musketeer and Madame Bonancieux. The former came forward 2 paces, and put D'Artagnan aside with his hand. D'Artagnan made 1 bound backwards and drew his sword.
At the same moment, and with the quickness of lightning, the stranger drew his.
"In God's name, my lord!" said Madame Bonancieux, throwing herself between the combatants, and seizing their swords with both her hands.
"My lord!" cried D'Artagnan, enlightened by a sudden idea. "My lord! Pardon me, sir, but can you be—"
"My Lord Duke of Buckingham!" said Madame Bonancieux in a very low voice. "And now you may destroy us all!"
"My lord, madame, pardon me, 1,000 pardons. But, my lord, I loved her and was jealous. You know, my lord, what it is to love. Pardon me and tell me how I may die in your grace's cause."
"You are a brave youth," said Buckingham, offering him a hand which D'Artagnan pressed respectfully. "You offer me your services, and I accept them. Follow us at the distance of 20 paces to the Louvre. And if anyone dogs our steps, kill him." D'Artagnan put his naked sword under his arm, let the Duke and Madame Bonancieux go forward about 20 steps, and then followed them, ready to execute to the letter the instructions of the elegant and noble minister of Charles I. But unfortunately, the young volunteer had no opportunity of affording this proof of his devotion to the Duke. And the young woman and the handsome musketeer entered the Louvre by the wicket in the Rue de l'Echelle without encountering any interruption. As for D'Artagnan, he went immediately to the Pineapple, where he found Porthos and Aramis waiting for him. But without giving them any further reason for the trouble he had caused them, he told them that he had concluded by himself the business for which he at first thought he should have wanted their assistance. And now, carried on as we have been by our history, let us leave our three friends to return each to his own home, whilst we follow, amidst the tortuous corridors of the Louvre, the Duke of Buckingham and his guide. 12. George Villiers, Duke of Buckingham. Madame Bonancieux and the Duke entered the Louvre without any difficulty. Madame Bonancieux was known to be of the household of the Queen, and the Duke wore the uniform of the musketeers of Monsieur de Tréville, who, as we have said, were on guard that evening. Besides, Germain was devoted to the Queen, and if anything happened, Madame Bonancieux would be accused of having introduced her lover into the Louvre. That was all. She took the blame upon herself. Her reputation would be lost, it is true, but of what value in the world was the reputation of a mercer's little wife? When they were once inside the court, the Duke and the young woman kept close to the wall for about 20 paces, at the end of which Madame Bonancieux tried a small private door, which was usually open during the day, but closed at night. The door opened, and they both entered, and found themselves in total darkness. But Madame Bonancieux was well acquainted with all the turnings and twistings of this part of the Louvre, which was appropriated to the persons of the royal suite. She shut all the doors behind her, took the Duke by the hand, and going some steps on tiptoe, seized hold of a banister, put a foot upon the staircase, and began to ascend it. The Duke had already counted 2 flights, when she turned to the left, went through a long corridor, descended another stage, walked a few steps forward, introduced a key into a lock, opened a door, and pushed her companion into a room lighted only by a night lamp, saying to him, "Remain here, my Lord Duke. Someone will come immediately." Then she went out by the same door, locking it after her, so that the Duke found himself literally a prisoner. Yet, though thus deserted, as it were, the Duke, it must be confessed, did not feel the slightest fear. One of the prominent features of his character was the love of adventure and romance. Brave, determined, and enterprising, it was not the first time he had risked his life in such adventures. He had learned that this pretended message of Anne of Austria, on the faith of which he had come to Paris, was a snare, and, instead of returning to England, he had taken advantage of his position and assured the Queen that he would not depart without seeing her. The Queen had at first positively refused an interview, but fearing lest the Duke might be guilty of some folly in his rage, she had resolved to see him and to entreat him to return directly. When, on the very evening on which Madame Bonancieux was charged to conduct him to the Louvre, that lady was herself carried off. During 2 days it was not known what had become of her, and everything continued in suspense. But Madame Bonancieux, once free and in communication with Laporte,
affairs had resumed their course, and she had now accomplished this perilous enterprise, which, but for her abduction, she would have executed 3 days before.
This is the end of disc number 4. Please insert disc number 5. This is disc number 5.
During 2 days, it was not known what had become of her, and everything continued in suspense. But Madame Bonancieux, once free and in communication with Laporte, affairs had resumed their course, and she had now accomplished this perilous enterprise, which, but for her abduction, she would have executed 3 days before. Buckingham, being left alone, approached a looking-glass. The dress of a musketeer became him wondrously. At 35 years old, he was justly considered as the handsomest man and the most complete gentleman of France or England. The favorite of 2 kings, rich as Croesus, all-powerful in a realm which he disturbed and tranquillized as he pleased, George Villiers, Duke of Buckingham, had engaged in one of those fabulous existences which remain, throughout the course of ages, an astonishment to posterity. Confident in himself, convinced of his power, and satisfied that the laws which restrain other people could not reach him, he went straight to the object he had fixed upon, even when that object was so elevated and so dazzling that it would have been madness in another to have even glanced towards it. It was thus that he had managed to approach the beautiful and haughty Anne of Austria many times, and to make her love him for his brilliant qualities. Placing himself before the glass, the Duke arrayed his beautiful fair hair, of which the pressure of his hat had disarranged the curls, and put his moustache in order. And then, his heart swelling with joy, happy and elated at having reached the moment he had so long desired, he smiled to himself, proudly and hopefully. At that moment, a door concealed in the tapestry opened, and a woman appeared. Buckingham saw the reflection in the glass. He uttered a cry. It was the Queen. Anne of Austria was at that time 26 or 27 years of age. That is, she was in all the glory of her beauty. Her deportment was that of a queen or a goddess. Her eyes, which shone like emeralds, were perfectly beautiful, but at the same time full of gentleness and majesty. Her mouth was small and rosy, and though her underlip, like that of the princes of the House of Austria, protruded slightly beyond the other, her smile was eminently gracious, but at the same time could be profoundly haughty in its scorn. Her skin was celebrated for its velvet softness, and her hand and arm were of such surpassing beauty as to be immortalized as incomparable by all the poets of the time. Admirably, too, did her hair, which in her youth had been fair, but had now become chestnut, and which she wore plainly dressed, and with a great deal of powder, shade a face on which the most rigid critic could have desired only a little less rouge, and the most fastidious sculptor only a little more delicacy in the formation of the nose. Buckingham remained an instant perfectly dazzled. Anne of Austria never had appeared to him so beautiful even in the midst of balls and festivals and entertainments as she now appeared, in her simple robe of white satin, and accompanied by Doña Estefana, the only one of her Spanish ladies who had not been driven from her by the jealousy of the king and the persecutions of the cardinal. Anne of Austria advanced 2 steps. The Duke threw himself at her feet, and before the queen could prevent him, had kissed the hem of her robe. "My lord, you already know that it was not I who sent for you from England." "Oh, yes, madame, yes, your majesty," exclaimed Buckingham. "I know that I have been a fool, a madman, to believe that the snow could have been animated, that the marble could grow warm. But what would you expect? The lover easily believes in love. Nor has my journey been entirely in vain, since I behold you now."
"Yes," replied Anne. "But you know why and how I see you, my lord. I see you because, insensible to all my distress, you persist in remaining in a city where, by remaining, you risk your own life and my honour. I see you to tell you that everything separates us, the depths of the sea, the enmity of nations, the sanctity of vows. It is sacrilege to struggle against such things, my lord. And lastly, I see you to tell you that I must never see you more.
Speak, madame, speak, queen, said Buckingham. The softness of your voice repays the sternness of your words. You speak of sacrilege, but the sacrilege is in the separation of hearts which God had formed for one another.
My lord, cried the queen, you forget that I have never said I loved you.
But neither have you ever said that you did not love me. And indeed, to say so would be a proof of the greatest ingratitude on the part of your majesty. For tell me, where would you find a love like mine, a love which neither time, nor absence, nor despair can extinguish, and which is recompensed by a riband, by a glance, a word? It is now 3 years, madame, since I saw you for the first time, and for 3 years have I adored you thus. Will you allow me to describe to you your dress on that occasion, and to tell the detail of the ornaments you wore? Mark me. I seem to see you now, seated in the Spanish manner, upon cushions, wearing a dress of green satin, embroidered in silver and in gold, with pendant sleeves fastened around your beautiful arms by large diamonds. You wore also a close ruff, and a small hat of the same color as your dress, and adorned with a heron's plume upon your head. Oh, thus with closed eyes do I behold you as you then were. And I open my eyes again only to see you now 100 times more lovely still.
What folly, murmured Anne of Austria, who dared not be offended with the Duke for preserving her portrait so faithfully in his heart. What folly to nourish so useless a passion on such memories as these!
Alas, what would your majesty exact? I have nothing but memories. They are my happiness, my treasure, and my hope. Each meeting with you is a new jewel that I enshrine within the casket of my heart. This is the fourth of them that you have let fall, and that I have eagerly secured. Yes, in 3 years, madame, I have seen you only 4 times. The first I have already recalled to you. The second was at Madame de Chevreuse's. The third was in the gardens of Amiens.
My lord, exclaimed the queen, blushing, do not refer to that evening.
Oh, rather let me dwell upon it, madame, for it is the one radiant, blissful night of my existence. Does your majesty remember how lovely a night it was? The air was laden with odoriferous sweetness, and the blue sky was studded with innumerable stars. Ah, madam, I was alone with you for an instant then, and you were about to make me the confidant of your griefs, of the isolation of your life and the deep sorrows of your heart. You were leaning on my arm, on this one, madam, and when I bent my head towards you, I felt my face gently touched by your beautiful hair, and every time that I so felt it, I trembled through every vein. Oh, queen, queen, you know not the heavenly bliss, the joys of paradise comprised in such a moment. Goods, fortune, glory, life, gladly would I give them all for another interview like that on such a night. For, madame, I will swear that then, at least on that night, you loved me.
My lord, it is possible that the influence of the place, the charm of that enchanted evening, the fascination of your looks, and the 1,000 circumstances which sometimes concur in leading a woman onwards to her fall, may have grouped themselves around me on that fatal night. But you are not ignorant, my lord, that the queen gave succor to the weakness of the woman, and that at the first word that you presumed to say, at the first liberty that you dared to take, I summoned others to my presence there.
Alas, it is but too true, and any feebler love than mine would never have survived the test. But my love, madame, came out from it more ardent and immortalized. You thought to escape from me by returning to Paris. You believed that I should never dare to quit the treasure which my master had commanded me to guard. But what cared I for all the treasures and all the kings upon the earth? In 1 week, madame, I was on my return. On that occasion, madame, you had nothing to complain of. I had risked favor and life to see you for a single second. I did not even touch your hand, and forgave me when you found I was submissive and repentant.
Yes, my lord, but you are well aware that calumny fastened